531.
Time for our weekly wrap-up of global politics with Dr. Stephen Hoadley, Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Arts. And this afternoon, Dr. Stephen, well, the big climate change summit kicking off in Glasgow next week. What is the aim and the outlook so far?
Good afternoon, Brian. Yes, it's a really big deal. There's going to be something like 125 national leaders, maybe 2,500 people will attend. That includes protesters, supporters, officials to advise their political masters. And it is, the great thing about it is that it's going to call attention to the Paris Agreement target to keep global warming under 1.5% of 1.5 degrees centigrade, after which time, if the globe heats up more than that, it may reach a tipping point and things will just spiral downwards, meaning hotter and hotter weather and worse weather. So that's encouraging that every government is being asked to declare a national commitment, that is to take the target and then translate that back into what kind of cutting back on greenhouse gases does each government have to do to make a proportionate contribution to the global target. That's the aim of this mega conference that's about to happen. Now, am I optimistic? Well, a couple of reasons for optimism is that 70% of world leaders have accepted a zero net carbon emissions target. Doesn't mean they've reached the target, but it just means they have made a commitment. That's up from 20% just a couple of years ago. So that's encouraging that governments do recognize that global warming is a problem. They do have some notion of the target they're trying to reach. Secondly, it's very well attended and very well publicized. There are full spread articles in the New Zealand Herald, which I read, probably also in the Dom Post, and in other news media. So climate change has arisen to the top of the agenda. All that's very encouraging, and governments will be under pressure to get results. Why am I pessimistic? Well, first of all, the greenhouse gas emissions are still going up. They continue to climb in spite of the fact that many governments, the European governments, and even the U.S. has reached a zero increase and actually decreased carbon emissions. But over the years, China, India, and the developing countries have developed more and more coal-fired electricity-generating stations. They're desperate for energy. They're trying to economically develop to catch up with us, the developed and industrialized West. And that demand for energy means a demand for coal, and burning coal creates increasing greenhouse gases. Secondly, we have a problem in the United States, which I'll talk about in a moment, that President Biden can't get his legislation through. Also, a number of governments like Brazil, Japan, Saudi Arabia, and Australia are trying to water down some of the reports by the International Panel on Climate Change. And they want to stress, let's not try to reduce emissions, but we'll try to capture the emissions by planting trees or by carbon sequestration, that is, drawing carbon out of the atmosphere. And they hope that technology and large-scale actions such as this will, in fact, create the zero carbon emissions target. Well, I'm a little bit pessimistic that the technology will do that. And the adaptation, the pledges of grants to poor countries for adaptation, that is building seawalls and otherwise physically preparing for higher sea levels, extreme weather conditions, cyclones, storm surges, forest fires, floods, and so forth. The pledges of actual contribution of aid are lagging, and therefore the poor countries are not getting the resources they need to actually build the physical infrastructure to help them guard against climate change. The ultimate dilemma, Brian, is that nobody can quite figure out who is responsible. The rich countries say, well, look, We're simply doing what we've always done, and we are trying to help the poor countries. The poor countries say, look, the rich countries caused the problem. They industrialized, they created greenhouse gases. They are obligated then to help us to both economically develop, but also to curb greenhouse gases. And then finally, climate migrants. Now, this is something New Zealand is painfully aware of because of the low-lying nature of many of its neighbors, and that if the sea level goes up, who is responsible for looking after those migrants? The 1951 Refugee Commission doesn't actually cover climate migrants, and therefore we have to find new legislation, new policies, new finance, and new concepts to meet what is going to be a growing problem. Well, we'll report more on this as the conference proceeds, Brian.
Talking about the United States, their efforts in regards to climate change, Dr. Stephen?
Well, President Biden has a very slim majority in the Senate, and one of his senators, Joe Manchin, is from West Virginia. Now, West Virginia is a coal mining state, and he will not have a bar of anything that constricts the use, the sale, the burning of coal. So consequently, the president is just short of one vote to pass legislation that would include electrification, it would include reduction of greenhouse gases, it would put the United States on quite a good track, setting a good example around the globe for attempting to meet the climate change problem. So politically, he is stymied, and consequently, he's going to have to find Plan B. Now, his officials have come out and said, look, climate change is not just a problem. It's actually a security issue. And by redefining climate change, not just as a problem, and they say an economic problem or a human problem, it's a climate of basics, an issue of basic security. Consequently, the Departments of Homeland Security, Department of Defense, National Security Council, the Director of National Intelligence have all issued reports putting climate change, along with COVID-19 and the challenge of China, at the top of their security agenda, arguing that climate change is going to cause food shortages, water shortages, it's going to increase the traffic through the Arctic Sea as the ice melts back, it's going to create resource conflicts amongst the five governments that border on the Arctic Sea, is going to create possibly more deprivation, which may fuel terrorism or radical policies, and consequently by redefining climate change as a security issue and broadening the concept of security, the United States is doing the right thing. It is helping to put climate change at the top of the agenda. So this is a hopeful sign. So we hope that President Biden can persuade Joe Manchin, West Virginia senator, to go along with his greenhouse gas mitigation policies in due course. And no doubt we'll report more on that next time we talk, Brian.
Now, the Australian Climate Council has issued a sobering report. Can you tell us more on that, Dr. Stephen?
Yes, to make a long story short, Australia is dead last. It is the worst in the Australian Climate Council's report. The council report is on the internet. It shows that there are 31 countries, and it ranks them by various policies and actions regarding mitigation of greenhouse gases, and Australia is dead last. Now, that's pretty bad news. And the Australian Council also says that Australia has spent only 2% of its economic stimulus money, the COVID stimulus money, on climate solutions, whereas Canada has spent 75% and the UK more than 20%. So Australia lagging pretty badly there. That the Senate, Australian Senate, has called for an assessment of climate change as a security issue, but the government has not acknowledged that. And we know that Scott Morrison is set on continuing the mining and the exporting of coal. And that he, as a consequence, a couple of former prime ministers of Australia have said that, look, Australia is in the grip of a toxic coalition, the Murdoch Press, which is a sort of Fox News right-wing press, sensational press, the vested interest in the fossil fuel sector, and the Liberal and National parties. That's the governing parties of Australia at the present time. And said that consequently, Australia is serving the coal barons rather than the public or the planet. And these two prime ministers, Malcolm Turnbull and Chris Rudd, have actually apologized to the Pacific Island governments, apologizing for Australia's backwards policy. Well, now, that's pretty bad. The unfortunate thing for New Zealand is that New Zealand is just above Australia. It is 30th on the Australian Climate Council list for also not having very progressive policies. I think that's a little bit unfair. New Zealand, in fact, has increased its funding for climate change adaptation on a person-to-person basis. It's pretty much up there with Great Britain in terms of generosity. And there's $1.3 billion to be spent in the next few years, most of it in the Pacific Islands. So I think the Australian Climate Council is a little bit harsh on New Zealand, but it certainly New Zealand could be doing more, and we doubtless will find out what James Shaw comes up with, because he's going to be our representative at the Glasgow conference in a couple of days, and will no doubt be reporting fully back. And we'll have a further conversation about this next week, Brian.
Okay. Now, New Zealand soon to get a trade deal with Great Britain. Some pros and cons from your perspective, Dr. Stephen.
Well, I think it's all pros in the sense that New Zealand has wanted this deal for a long time. When Great Britain left the European Union, it was quite desperate to form up a number of new trade agreements. New Zealand was near the top of the list. Turned out Australia was at the top of the list. And so New Zealand now is just now catching up with Australia with the deal that it has. It's a good deal. It does reduce tariffs almost immediately for most products. There will be a longer phase-out period for those sensitive products. Of meat and dairy, but this is pretty standard in agreements like that, so nothing too unusual there. We will have to accept all of Britain's products duty-free, but that's pretty much what we've done already anyway, and we'll have to accept the Britain's copyright protections will extend out to 20 years for their intellectual property, their music, their videos, and so forth. Well, we can live with that. I think in that respect, the figures put forward indicate that New Zealand could gain something like some billions of dollars, $1 billion a year in terms of not having to pay tariffs, increased trade to Great Britain, the income that comes from that. But critics have pointed out, well, look, that's not a big deal. If you put that over the number of years and put that against the gross domestic product, it comes out something like less than 1% of GDP. In fact, 0.1% of 1% GDP. So it is not going to make us rich. It's a plus, and I think that anything above the line is better than something below the line. But it's not going to be the breakthrough that is going to create a total lucrative market for New Zealand products. It'll be an improvement over the existing hard work that the dairy board and the meat people have done to pry open the British market. And the other good thing is that it will set an example, because New Zealand is in the middle of negotiations with the European Union. And so New Zealand can say, look, we've got this agreement in principle with the UK. Why don't we have equal terms with you? And the Europeans will say, oh, yeah, maybe we should do that to be consistent. So it is a kind of door opener for New Zealand and the European market. Add all of that together, along with all the other good marketing work that the private sector has done, then New Zealand will continue to export. New Zealand's standard of living will remain relatively high in the world. And so all that is a good thing. So I give full marks to our negotiators who have been working at this for many years, all the way back to the 1970s when Britain joined the European Union and partly closed New Zealand out of the British market, not entirely, but partly. And now we're back into it So this is, in some respects, an historic step forward for New Zealand marketing and for the New Zealand economy, Brian.
And finally, recent China activity in the Pacific region. Give us an update, please.
Yes, well, I've had a lot of critical things to say about China in the past. I'm going to say something nice about China. The Pacific leaders, foreign ministers, have gotten together by video link, which is pretty standard these days. The upcoming APEC summit hosted by New Zealand will be by video link. And the foreign ministers have met with the foreign minister of China. They have agreed to the establishment of a China Pacific Island Countries Fund. So China is going to send more money to the Pacific Islands, not project by project, but perhaps in a more multilateral way, which the Pacific Island leaders can tap into for projects they think are important, not just projects that Chinese think are important. There have been previous meetings of the China Pacific Island Countries Economic Development Cooperation Forum, so there's consultation going on. That must be a good thing. It's all part of President Xi Jinping's Global Development Initiative. And very specifically, the Chinese have agreed they're going to send down the China Vax and China Farm vaccines to the Pacific. They've already begun supplying 80,000 Sinopharm vaccines to Vanuatu, and that model will be used. So hopefully countries like Papua New Guinea that are facing a national emergency of COVID-19 and are calling desperately for international help, the Chinese seem to be on the way with their vaccine and hopefully with their medical personnel as well to administer that vaccine. So I would say in this case, China looks like it's doing the right thing. As long as there are no political strings attached, as long as the Chinese Navy doesn't require basing rights as a quid pro quo, as long as the Pacific Island leaders are consulted on a basis of equality or at least equity with their Chinese benefactors, then we would say, welcome China. Any help to curb this coronavirus is most welcome in our part of the world. Brian.
Dr. Stephen Hoad, the Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Arts, for another week of global politics. Thank you as always for your time, Dr. Stephen, and we'll look forward to your company again same time next Wednesday. Thank you and have a great day.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian.